From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. Coming up, as college grads collect their diplomas, the realities of starting a new career in the middle of an economic downturn. And on this Memorial Day weekend, a tribute to casualties of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars.
The biggest fear some of these parents have is that nobody will remember the sacrifices of their youngster.
Also, William Saroyan put Fresno on the literary map. We'll hear how the city is returning the favor on the centennial of his birth. And how a routine loyalty oath from the Cold War era cost a Cal State professor her job.
I just blurted out, "I can't sign the oath." And then there was kind of a hush in the room with people looking at me, and I felt very kind of uncomfortable.
I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is the California Report. Good to have you with us on this holiday weekend. It's a time when graduation season is in full swing, and 150,000 or so college seniors are poised to enter what their parents often call the real world. Clutching their diplomas, these intrepid job hunters have begun fanning out, looking for that entry-level position they hope will kickstart a career. This year, as Elaine Corey reports, the job market is anything but certain.
One good place for college seniors to launch their job hunt is at a career fair, where at least the recruiters come to them. UC Davis sponsored such a fair earlier this month. More than 150 employers are represented here today, ranging from the hip clothing line Abercrombie & Fitch.
We're definitely hiring. Yeah.
Definitely hiring. Expanding as a company, we're looking for managers in training.
A little bit about our brands right here.
To the multinational ad agency Zenith Optimedia.
Really team-oriented. You're going to be working with a lot of people. You're going to be reaching out to sales reps from different websites and magazines.
Firms in high-tech, advertising, finance, and solar power all sent recruiters. So that means that the job market must be solid, right? Nationally, the labor picture looks surprisingly strong. Employers surveyed in March said they expect to increase their hiring of college grads by 8% compared to last year. But in California, where unemployment is more than a full percentage point higher than the national average, the outlook is not so rosy.
It's pretty bleak at this point in time.
That's Joel Bushak, 22, who majored in international relations and Spanish. He wants a job in bilingual marketing, but he's anxious about breaking into the field. He notes that college grads are also competing against the thousands of workers who've been laid off in California as the economy has slowed.
The only advantage that I think we have is the fact that a lot of the older generations of baby boomers are going to be retiring in the near future. And I think that hopefully will open up some jobs, but those jobs could disappear because of the economic recession that we're in the middle of right now.
Many students have scaled down their expectations. They're taking 5 years to finish their degrees, cooling their heels in graduate school, or like Bushak, they're planning to move back home until they land that first job. Bushak says his parents have been supportive.
They understand the situation. These days, a lot of people are doing that just because it's the state of the economy. It's tough. It's not like it was, you know, even 10 years ago when people were just getting jobs. You know, the dot-com boom is over, and the market isn't as strong as it was.
Adina Freycash is an exercise biology major who's graduating in June. She'd like to run a sports program for kids, maybe juveniles in detention. But like Bushak, she finds the job market daunting.
I've read statistics that it's better than last year, but it's definitely still intimidating to try to break into that. So I have applied for a few jobs, and I'm still definitely looking.
Career counselors have been telling seniors to stay optimistic, that there are jobs out there. Naomi Kinnard runs the Internship and Career Center at UC Davis.
They just have to be a little bit more persistent in their job searching. It might take a little longer than it would have maybe last year to land a job. They have to market themselves, communicate their skills clearly, and demonstrate why they should be selected as the candidate.
Kinnard says a lot of job search is a numbers game. The more applications go out, the better the odds of success. So she advises seniors to strategically target lots of companies. But that hasn't worked for everybody.
My name's Erin Tenner. I'm a Communications and American Studies double major, and I'm graduating in June.
So what do you think the job market looks like?
Not so good. As someone who's looking for jobs currently, it's been really hard.
What's your strategy?
Finding everyone I know who knows someone and going that way has been probably the most successful thus far.
Networking.
Yeah.
In fact, persistence and a little luck should pay off for desirable job candidates. Many sectors of California's economy are growing, from computer science and engineering to green industries such as alternative energy. Anything in the healthcare field is hot. And as a graduate of the prestigious UC system, Erin Tanner knows she's a contender.
I'm hopeful. I'm starting to get interviews, and so I'm hoping I can charm someone, right? That's all I ask for.
Tanner can't afford to give up. She wants to make it on her own without further help from mom and dad. For the California Report, I'm Elaine Corey in Davis.
A lot of us think of Memorial Day weekend as the unofficial start of summer, a time for barbecues and road trips, if you can afford to fill up your tank, that is. But for military families, the holiday is something else altogether, a time to remember friends and loved ones who died serving their country. 2 years ago, a tribute to the dead from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars was dedicated on the 10th floor of the Marines Memorial Club in downtown San Francisco. Like the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, this wall includes the names of each of the dead, gold letters inscribed in small bricks of black marble. This week I visited the wall with the organization's president and CEO, retired Major General Mike Myatt.
We have displayed in this room here the names of all the youngsters we've lost in Iraq and Afghanistan since 9/11. And if you were to put a sticker on a block of somebody from California, you would be amazed. It's really about 10% of the casualties in this war are Californians. So the Gold Star parents ask us to help them network. And that's when we realize that the biggest fear some of these parents have is that nobody will remember the sacrifices of their youngster. It hasn't changed our lives here on a daily basis, but it certainly has changed the military's lives. It's changed their families' lives. And they really feel that nobody is paying any attention to the fact that they've lost their loved one. And we've really now had three big events where our Gold Star parents have come here. They'll come and they'll sit on these chairs here in front of this wall. They'll sit for hours. They'll then get up and want to touch the particular brick that has their son or daughter's name on there, and then they'll come back and sit down. And it's really quite touching to see how it's so meaningful to them that there is one place where their son or daughter is being remembered.
It's very simple and sort of stark in its simplicity. There's an American flag in the corner. There's a small plaque in the middle, and then you've got thousands of small black bricks with the gold lettering. Was there any particular thinking about keeping it simple?
Yes, we wanted it to be simple, and we wanted it to be something that this room could handle. The problem is that, as you can see, by running out of room, we are going to have to make an extension to this wall some way. But we're going to continue on with it as long as we can.
You're a veteran, of course. You served in Vietnam a couple of tours. You retired as a major general. What does this wall mean to you?
Well, it always brings back a flood of memories because as a commander of Marines, one of the things as a young lieutenant, I promised myself I would never forget the name of a young Marine who lost his life at carrying out one of my orders. And the unfortunate thing is that the list got so long that I can't remember. Now I have to I keep it in my computer. But to me, it brings back a flood of memories. I see the youth, you know, the Lance Corporals, the PFCs, the sergeants. These are young Americans who, they're just bright young kids. And they go off and serve their country. You know, they might be the ones that cure a disease or invent something that could do great things for mankind, but their lives were cut so short. So it's really a special place, this room.
You know, I wouldn't have expected that a retired major general would be as emotional as you are about this.
They lie to you. They tell you time heals. Time doesn't heal. The scabs scrape off the wounds in a heartbeat when those people mean so much to you. You know, you end up loving these Marines, and when you lose one, it's a little bit of your heart goes with it.
What do you hope people think about on Memorial Day this year?
Well, I hope they really think about these youngsters whose names are on this wall and thank them for their services and remember what they could have done. I also hope that they'll send their best thoughts for those youngsters who are serving overseas in harm's way today, and that we sure would hope that we can bring them back.
Retired Major General Mike Myatt. He's president of the Marines Memorial Association in San Francisco, home of the Tribute Memorial Wall. A Cal State University professor has lost her job because she refused to sign a Cold War-era loyalty oath. The oath includes a pledge to defend the U.S. and California constitutions against all enemies, foreign and domestic. The lifelong pacifist isn't the only one. Over the years, several other aspiring public employees in California have also been fired for doing the same thing. L.A. Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
Your first day at a job usually isn't the day you want to start rocking the boat. But Wendy Gonover felt she had no other choice. It was orientation day last autumn. Gonover had just been hired as an adjunct professor at California State University, Fullerton. Sitting in a room full of new hires, Gonover listened to the orientation leader tell them they were required to sign the state's loyalty oath.
She asked at one point any questions, and I raised my hand, and I said, well, what kind of exceptions do you make for religious minorities? She said, none. And I just blurted out, I can't sign the oath. And then there was kind of a hush in the room with people looking at me, and I felt very kind of uncomfortable.
Gonover has a PhD in American Studies, and she knows the U.S. Constitution inside and out. She says forcing employees to sign an oath to defend the Constitution is, well, unconstitutional. But Gonover's objection went beyond her role as a constitutional scholar. As a practicing Quaker and pacifist, Gonover says she can't sign an oath that requires her to, quote, defend the U.S. and state constitutions against enemies, foreign and domestic.
The combination of the word defend with enemies seems to me to be a statement in favor of a military defense, even if you yourself aren't participating in it.
Gonover offered to sign the oath as long as she could include an attachment expressing her opinion that the oath violated her First Amendment rights to freedom of religion and speech. Officials at California State University rejected the statement, and Gonover was out of a job. In a statement to the California Report, CSU spokeswoman Clara Potts Fellow said CSU must follow the state law that says all employees are required to sign the oath. And because Gonover's addendum negated the oath, CSU was forced to fire her.
We work with them, we meet and confer with them, and we try to work out whatever issues they have so that they can sign it.
That's California Assistant Attorney General Jacob Applesmith. He has the unenviable job of helping the public interpret an oath written during the height of the Cold War. In the 1950s, loyalty oaths were added to the constitutions of many states. The idea was to prevent communists from infiltrating local government. Applesmith says nowadays the oath should not be interpreted as a call to arms, rather an agreement to abide by the laws of state and country.
If someone wants to specify that they cannot engage in acts of physical violence, that's fine.
Through the years, the oath has survived constitutional challenges in court. In one decision, personal statements accompanying the oath were allowed, as long as they didn't negate the meaning of the oath. But that hasn't stopped people from getting fired. Take Bud Tillinghast, for example. In 1995, Humboldt State University gave the Methodist minister 30 days to sign the oath. He refused. On the 31st day, he was in the middle of teaching a class on world religion.
It ended up where I was escorted from the classroom by a couple of campus police because I wouldn't sign the loyalty oath.
Currently, almost all 2.3 million public employees in California are required to sign the oath, as long as they're U.S. citizens, no matter what kind of job they have. When Lynn Fiume wanted to volunteer for the Botanic Gardens at UC Riverside, she discovered she had to sign the oath, too.
I remember asking the director, I said, really? You really make people sign this so that they can pull weeds?
Since you've been pulling weeds, have any enemies, foreign or domestic, approached you?
No. It was funny. My first thought when I was reading it, one of my thoughts was, you know, all of us up there with our little trowels defending the Botanic Gardens against some kind of, you know, invading presence coming in. So on the one hand, I was sort of laughing. It seemed so absurd. And on the other hand, I thought it was sort of offensive.
In the end, says Fiume, she decided to sign it, deciding the whole thing was rather silly. That's not the conclusion that Wendy Gonover and her lawyers reached. They think this is a serious constitutional issue that needs to be resolved. They've been in talks with CSU officials on a compromise. They say they're hopeful Gonover will soon win her job back. For the California Report, I'm Rob Schmitz in Los Angeles.
It's a chilly and foggy morning in Oakland, but Bobby Sharp is in a t-shirt and jeans with hot steam rising from his work gloves.
I'm trying to get it all the way in.
Wearing thick safety glasses, he puts a long, thin piece of iron in a 2300-degree forge. Sharp's been a blacksmith for over 30 years. He specializes in creating custom works of art. His shop is set up in the backyard of his Oakland home. It overlooks a view of San Francisco and gets a fresh breeze right off the bay.
The old adage, strike while the iron's hot. When it's red hot, you got to get it out.
He pulls the iron bar out of the forge with his gloves and sticks it in a tall barrel of water.
And this is your quench. You cool it with water, you cool it off. Then I can grab it.
Blacksmithing dates back centuries and has been used to create everything from weapons to candlestick holders. Sharp continues to work in the same vein as the craftsmen before him. Despite the convenience of the local Home Depot, Sharp makes all of his tools by hand.
Before the Industrial Revolution, when anybody wanted a shovel, a pick, a chisel, or whatever, you went to the blacksmith, he made you the tool. That's where you got them from.
Sharp is making a sculptured iron fence for a private home. He calls it the seawall. It's one of his most prized creations so far. When looked at from a distance, a breaking ocean wave appears. He lifts the hot iron from the water and strikes it on an anvil. The straight iron rod curves with each hit. He then twists it with a monkey wrench.
See, the way that twists, easy. It's like, you know, plastic. Try doing that when it's not hot.
The Oakland native first got a taste of blacksmithing in an 8th grade metal shop class. He went on to earn a degree in art with a focus on metal sculpture and history. In the 70s, he came across the work of the honored 20th century blacksmith C. Carl Jennings at a crafts fair in San Francisco.
He was heating up the iron red hot and making hooks and handles and bottle openers and things like that. And when I saw what he was doing with the metal, I said, this is exactly what I want to do.
It was around this time that blacksmithing was elevated from the status of a practical trade to an art form. Blacksmiths came together to form the California Blacksmith Association. The group holds conferences and offers workshops from how to build a basic fire to the latest forging techniques. As interest in the art of blacksmithing has grown over the last 30 years, so has the demand for custom-made metal items.
You see a lot of ironwork in the catalogs. You see iron-formed lamps and bedspreads and bedsteads, bed headboards and footboards and lamps.
Isn't this a cool machine?
Back in his shop, Sharp uses a power hammer to add a final texture to the iron bar. He proudly displays his creation, just one small detail of a fence made up of many painstakingly crafted pieces. With stores across the country selling mass-produced and imported metalwork at low costs, surviving as an independent blacksmith is no easy task. But Sharp says it's the ability to turn a plain bar of steel into a unique work of art that lures people into the craft. And he looks forward to the next generation of blacksmiths.
It really does take the tradition and the past knowledge of the blacksmith to raise and train a new blacksmith. Everything that has been done, that is being done now, has been done in the past. And this community that we have as blacksmiths is a wonderfully open community, and we open our arms to anybody who wants to learn it.
You can check out photos of Bobby Sharp's work, including the seawall, at californiareport.org. William Saroyan, the Pulitzer Prize and Oscar-winning author, brought Tales of California to life through a prolific body of work that included novels, essays, paintings, and screenplays. Much of it was rooted in his life as the son of Armenian-American immigrants growing up in Fresno. And that city is rolling out the red carpet to honor the 100th anniversary of Saroyan's birth, with more than 100 events planned to honor his legacy. Central Valley Bureau Chief Sasha Coca explains how Saroyan put Fresno on the literary map.
On a spring afternoon, bicycle riders toot their horns and pull to a stop along a path in Fresno's Woodward Park.
I'm John Kallenberg, and I'm chairman of the William Saroyan Society, and I thank you all for participating in today's bike ride. I'll do a little reading here, what Saroyan had to say about his bikes.
The cyclists dismount their bikes to read excerpts from Saroyan's 1952 memoir, The Bicycle Rider of Beverly Hills.
Moving the legs evenly and steadily soon brings home to the bike rider a valuable knowledge of pace and rhythm and a sensible
respect. Saroyan rode bicycles for most of his life, first as a teenage telegraph messenger in Fresno. It was a role he fictionalized in one of his earliest novels, The Human Comedy, set in a central California town he called Ithaca, a thinly disguised Fresno. Here, Saroyan reads a passage where the young messenger delivers a telegram to a woman whose son has been killed in battle.
Now suddenly she began to make strange, soft, breathing sounds, holding herself in, as if weeping were a disgrace. Homer wanted to get up and run, but he knew he would stay. He even thought he might stay the rest of his life.
The movie version of The Human Comedy, starring Mickey Rooney, earned Saroyan an Oscar in 1943. But the short story was the form that really propelled him to fame. He wrote in intense athletic bursts, crafting stories that appealed to downbeat Depression-era readers. Churning out nearly a book a year for over four decades, Saroyan drew on his memories of Fresno's endless vineyards and his time living in San Francisco, Paris, and New York. He experimented with essays, memoirs, and plays. He painted watercolors and even dabbled as a songwriter with the hit Come On to My House.
Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you candy. Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you apple, a plum, and a pomegranate too.
Other writers praised Saroyan for his idealism. His 1939 play, The Time of Your Life, was set in a San Francisco saloon. It won the Pulitzer Prize, but Saroyan rejected the award, saying art could not be patronized by wealth. Later in life, Saroyan struggled with debt, gambling, and a failed marriage. He eventually returned to Fresno and to his bicycle. Armenian-American author Mark Arox remembers the man with a drooping walrus mustache and some eccentric habits.
Let's say he would eat a can of green beans, and he would take the label off the green beans and then write on the back, you know, green beans, July 20th, 1969, 4 p.m. You know, that's when he consumed them. So the question for me became, had his eccentricities turned into madness? Was he documenting all the external facets of a writer for us to maybe look back on?
Saroyan would sit in his backyard and interview himself with a tape recorder, like in this 1975 recording where he asked himself about his relationship to Fresno, a city he'd been eager to leave as a young adult, but a place whose rich mix of immigrant cultures continued to draw him back.
Fresno is a good place. It's the world, and how good can the world be in any case, wherever you go? How much different from Fresno is Paris? If you're there, you're there. And you can see and feel a culture, and you can see and feel a culture in Fresno, too.
Saroyan was a mentor to Arox and would ask him to bring over cassette tapes so he could record the sounds out his window.
And it was just, you know, 45 minutes of complete silence, and then you'd hear a buzz of a fly or maybe a chirp of a robin in the morning, and he would get this big smile on his face as he played it. But, you know, this man was incredibly alive, even though he was living a life of a hermit in some ways.
Today, many of Saroyan's books are out of print, but the Armenian-American community continues to revere him, the son of immigrants who made it to Broadway and Hollywood. To Fresno, he's almost a patron saint whose scrawling signature is plastered on the walls of the downtown theater named after him. Yet to his own son, the poet Aram Saroyan, He was a difficult and complex character. The elder Saroyan disinherited his family and said he didn't want to see them as he lay dying in his hospital bed.
Okay, he went crazy. He had terminal cancer, you know. As the years go by, you realize, hey, he was a great guy when he was not crazy. And there was a lot of good. And people are palettes, you know. They have dark colors, they have bright colors, they have everything going on in them.
Playwright, songwriter, short story author, and self-chronicler, Saroyan devoured life. In his famous preface to The Daring Young Man on the Flying Trapeze, he gave this advice to writers. Try as much as possible to be wholly alive with all your might, and when you laugh, laugh like hell. And when you get angry, get good and angry. Try to be alive. You will be dead soon enough. Saroyan's legacy is wholly alive with all its might for the rest of 2008, with dozens of readings, lectures, screenings, and exhibits planned in Fresno. The Fresno Bee is even printing regular installments of one of Saroyan's unpublished manuscripts. For the California Report, I'm Sasha Coca in Fresno.
And that's our show for today. California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. Seal Muller is the technical producer. We also had engineering from Howard Gelman and Danny Bringer. The online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are Ali Tabatabai, Harry Gregory, Leanne Lucetta, and June Stinson. She produced our profile of Bobby Sharp, the blacksmith. Thanks also to Valley Public Radio for their production help this week. Our producer is Victoria Malione. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Raul Ramirez is the executive producer. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great Memorial Day weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California, and the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, rating hospital quality in California. On the web at calhospitalcompare.org.